The views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and are not necessarily those of the Information Radio Network, its affiliates, stations, or advertisers.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest this evening, and our special guest is Mr. John Williams. Well, his name is Walter Williams, but he goes by John. His middle initial is a J, Walter J. Williams, and he is a Ph.D. economist who publishes something known as the Shadow Statistics. And of course, we are living in very, very difficult times financially, and unfortunately, so much of the material that is put out by our federal government in the way of statistics really are not accurate or true. America has had a fiat money system, well, really since August of 1971, and there's no incidence in all history where a fiat money system has survived over a long period of time. Of course, really, the whole world's on a fiat money system. The world is frantically inflating the monetary supply, which throughout history has always led to disaster. But you're not getting this information. In fact, I am in the process of reading Alan Greenspan's book, The Age of Turbulence, and he keeps talking about interest rates, but only, well, I've never heard him mention, I've never seen him mention M1, M2, or M3. Talks a little bit about liquidity, but he never really tells you what he's talking about. And to the average individual, unless you've studied this sort of thing, it's just nothing but confusion. So to help us clarify what's really going on, Mr. Williams, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Monty. Please call me John.
All right, John. Well, thank you. Call me Stan, or look forward to it, to talking to this evening. Now, certainly you've been going over the government statistics and trying to make some sense out of them, and what's really going on? We hear now that there's a little bit of inflation in the food industry, but there's nothing much to worry about, that this is going to take care of itself, and people seem to be a little concerned because the dollar's falling, but maybe that'll make our goods more competitive internationally. Where are we headed economically from the point of view of an economist who looks at this objectively?
Well, we're already heading into or in a disaster. But before I get into that, if I could just clarify a couple of quick points. First, I don't have my doctorate. I have an MBA from the Tuck Business School, but I've been a consulting economist. Very active in the field for going on 30 years now. And what we're looking at here with government statistics is something that I found I had to get into early on with some of my first consulting accounts. I had some very large Fortune 50 companies who used my forecast, and one was a commercial airplane manufacturer, had a model that predicted what revenue passenger miles would be doing. That was their primary sales forecasting tool. All of a sudden, it wasn't working. It was driven by the government's, what was then called GNP, now called GDP, the broadest measure of the economy by the gross domestic product account. And there were some serious problems with the with those numbers because of some problems with trade statistics. I corrected the numbers, and later the government made similar adjustments, and with that the models worked. But I found then that I really had to get into detail with each of these statistics that are so heavily relied upon by the markets, and what I have found is that over time, the various processes and changes in methodologies have built biases into the system so that the...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is John Williams. And so John is telling us how he really got into doing these private statistics as a consultant for industry and for Fortune 500 companies. He found that if you relied on the government statistics, many times they were misleading. And so he had to calculate the statistics about what was really happening to our economy on his own. So you've been doing this for many years?
Going on 30 years.
Okay.
And what I found very simply is that over time there have been biases built into the system that tend to overestimate and overstate economic growth. So the GDP numbers are too strong. It understates the inflation rate. So the CPI numbers are too soft. Understates the unemployment rate. So the unemployment rate's really quite a bit higher. And it's interesting, about 10 years ago, the Kaiser Foundation conducted the survey in conjunction with the Washington Post to see what the average American thought of the current inflation rate and such. What they found was that the perceived inflation was about double what was being reported by the government, as was the unemployment rate, and the level of economic growth was about half that was being reported. And the Washington Post took this and said, oh, look how stupid the public is. My point is how stupid the Washington Post is, because the American public, if you're out there in the real world working day to day, you've got a pretty good idea what's going on, where real inflation is. And what's happened is that the government statistics have moved away from what would reflect common experience. And when they no longer reflect common experience, they really have very little value outside of academia or the spinmeister rooms of the of Wall Street, where they're trying to sell stocks and bonds. If you look at the history here, and I do like to look at history some, because it helps explain how things have evolved and how we've gotten into really an extraordinary mess that probably foreshadows the greatest financial catastrophe ever seen in modern history, to give you a little preview of where this all ends up. But if you go back before World War II, there were not many economic statistics as we have today. You had a crude industrial production number that was published by the Federal Reserve. The CPI existed in a preliminary form.
I'm going to ask you if you'll just hold that thought for just a moment as we bring other stations right back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is John Williams, he's an economist, and he's simply saying that everything that is going on today may be, say, a prelude to one of the greatest financial catastrophes of all times, and that so many of the government statistics have nothing to do with what's really going on. He talks about the CPI. Now, for those of you who are not economists, that's the Consumer Price Index, and certainly the Consumer Price Index has been around for a long time, but sometimes it has very little to do with the reality of what prices are that the average individual is going to be paying just simply to live and to get by and to provide for his family. So please pick up the story there, John.
Sure. In the period before World War II, the way people estimated how the economy was going, aside from their own gut reaction and what they were seeing with their own business activity, was they watched the stock market. Stock market was up, the economy was good, it was down, it was bad. And when the market crashed in 29 and Hoover was faced with the Great Depression, he had no idea how bad it was. He knew it was bad, but he had no way of measuring it. An old friend of mine, late Al Sendlinger, knew Hoover from the time when he was Commerce Secretary, when Hoover was Commerce Secretary. And I did some early consumer polling for Paramount Pictures, trying to see what kind of pictures people liked, but whether he was getting some sense of how the economy was going. And he shared that information with Hoover. after the war, Hoover set him up in business as an alternate source for economic data for presidents going forward. He never wanted to see another U.S. president who didn't know what was happening with the U.S. economy. At the same time, the national income accounts and such were being brought to the fore. These are things like the gross national product and the unemployment, current unemployment reporting, all came after World War II, and Hoover recognized that those numbers would quickly get politicized. So he wanted an alternative, and Sindlinger started an early consumer confidence survey, which he continued through his death in, I think it was 2000, and consulted with a number of presidents, and his numbers tended to indicate some very similar patterns to things I've seen with my own numbers at times when the government statistics were going in the other direction. And the reason the government statistics start to go in the other direction has to go with along with the fact that, yep, sure enough, politics came into the picture, and presidents or the different administrations went to work on improving the reporting.
In other words, they lied. They changed the figures because they wanted to look good?
Absolutely.
All right, well.
Starting back with the Kennedy administration. Keep in mind, now that's
the Kennedy
a little over 10 years into the new post-World War II era and the new economic data.
Sure, that's 47 years ago.
But they had they wanted to improve the unemployment rate. It wasn't actually accomplished until the Johnson administration, but the concept was to introduce the idea of a discouraged worker. If you were unemployed, you wanted a job, you were able to work, you met all the qualifications at that time for being unemployed, except if you'd given up looking for a job because there was no work to be had in the area where you lived, you were then classified as a discouraged worker and put into a different class of unemployment. And at one point, the government reported 8 levels of unemployment, including the discouraged workers. But the popularly followed unemployment rate is the one called U3. It's the third level of unemployment.
What do you think the unemployment level would be at the end of the present time?
Well, right now it's at 4.7%.
All right.
But jumping ahead some administrations, in the Clinton administration, they decided to redefine discouraged workers. And if you'd been a discouraged worker for more than a year, you were just eliminated from the data. That knocked about 4.5 million people off the broader unemployment rolls. But if you head back in, the way the numbers were counted, the unemployment rate's up around 12%, not 4.7%. So that's an indication right there that things are not quite as indicated. But the funny thing is, that's very close to the number that the Kaiser Foundation got when it took its broad survey of the American people 10 years ago. Hasn't changed that much. In the Johnson administration, Lyndon Johnson was noted for reviewing the what was then called the gross national product, a slightly broader version of the gross domestic product. It is the broadest measure of economic activity, and he'd look at it, and if he didn't like it, he'd send it back to the Commerce Department, and he'd keep sending it back to the Commerce Department until they got the reporting right. Very simple, straightforward, and clearly manipulated. Nixon had problems with his Labor Department on the labor statistics. Very lengthy stories there, but he made his effort at manipulation. Don't have anything on the Ford administration and the Carter administration. There was some manipulation that was noted in the press of inflation numbers. In the Reagan administration, began to see some changes in the GDP, the broadest economic measure, some changes starting in the Consumer Price Index. And then with a crash in 1987, we saw a very overt manipulation of the trade data aimed at trying to stabilize the dollar after Mr. Greenspan had abandoned the dollar. In the immediate wake of the stock market crash, the new Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, decided to let the dollar fall and to concentrate on supporting the U.S. market. And it worked, but the dollar did fall very sharply. And that had to be addressed, or another crash was pending. And through a combination of extraordinarily massive intervention and a direct change in the trade data, they were able to turn the dollar to the upside in early 1988. Coming into the first Bush administration is where we get to the point that the numbers really become, I think maybe even vicious is the right term. It actually is aimed at hurting people. Late first Bush administration, Michael Boskin, who was then the head of the Council of Economic Advisers, and then Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, started talking about how the Consumer Price Index really overstated inflation. Their argument went along the lines that, well, you know, if steak goes up in price, it's really not fair to just measure the price of steak there, because people are going to start buying more hamburger, and if you buy more hamburger, then your cost of living isn't going up so much. And the reason for that, the reason for making that big push and how the CPI really should be showing lower inflation, was that if they could show lower CPI, it would lower the cost of living adjustments that were made to such things as the annual Social Security payments, the annual adjustments to the Social Security payments.
In other words, they altered the figures so they wouldn't have to give the elderly, the retired people, as much money. Is that it?
That's what they wanted to do, and that's effective. That's what they accomplished. It took them a little bit to do it, but Social Security checks would be nearly 100% higher today had the things that took place not taken place. And what where things really went awry here is, if you look at the Consumer Price Index and its original intent, as it was used in the post-World War II era with the auto union contracts, it was designed to measure your cost of living. How much more money do I need this year to have the same standard of living that I had the year before? And the way it would be done is they'd, using a very simplistic approach here, they'd measure, let's say, the price of a gallon of milk, a loaf of bread, and a pound of steak. And then they'd measure those same items again the next year, and whatever the change was, that would be the rate of inflation and how much your income would have to go up in order to maintain the same standard of living. It was designed to maintain a constant standard of living. Now, by introducing the concept of, well, we can substitute hamburger for steak if steak gets too expensive, completely it destroyed that concept and went from maintaining a constant standard of living to being one of a declining standard of living. In fact, really, it was a cost of a survival. You can go from steak to hamburger to dog food and keep going down the scale. And you put dog food prices in place of hamburger, you can keep the CPI relatively low. So they wanted to go to a substitution effect with the goods instead of having a constant basket of goods, as they called it. That actually created some furor in Congress, and the idea was largely dropped. But when the Clinton administration came in, the Bureau of Labor Statistics changed the way they weighted the Consumer Price Index from a straight arithmetic weighting to what they call a geometric weighting. And the nice thing about that is that if something goes up sharply in price, the weighting goes down, and if it goes down in price, the weighting goes up. And that had the effect, the same effect of having something like a substitution bias. And that's that's where the they got the Social Security with it.
In other words, basically what they were really trying to do was deceive Congress, deceive the American people, and doing it all with figures. And, of course, the figures don't lie, and they forgot that liars can figure, and that's one reason why the statistics are not valid.
Yep.
Okay, we'll pick the story up from there, please.
Okay, well, coming into the Clinton administration...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
which was the gross amount of money and time deposits and in banks all over the world, all the money and credit that there is. And it is a reflection, certainly, of where the inflation is going to be going. If it's contracting, of course, the economy will be contracting. If it's expanding, why, it's highly inflationary, and especially at the levels as it is today. And they are simply deceiving the American people, in my impression, because they don't want them to realize that they are in the process of destroying the value of our currency by massively increasing the amount of money and credit that's available there. And of course, inflation is really an expansion of the money supply, and the rising prices are simply a reflection of inflation. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes. And the Fed knows it, and you have to, it's difficult to come up with a positive or honest, not honest, not the right term, but to come up with a reason that shows a positive motive at the Fed for discontinuing M3. They said, oh, it didn't mean anything, too expensive to maintain. Again, they have, they still report most of the components. I think basically they didn't want people to see how rapidly M3 growth was going to pick up. And it has picked up because we continue to track it. We look at the missing components, the non-M2, it's M3 is M2 plus the large time deposits, institutional money funds and such.
Well, of course, what is M3 about at the present time?
I'm sorry?
What is M3 at the present time?
Well, it's around $1.2 trillion, and we're seeing growth of over 14.5%.
So it's increasing at the rate of 14.5% a year. Now, I think most people really don't understand how devastating inflation is as far as their savings, as far as everything that they have that's denominated in dollars.
That's the highest level of M3 growth since late 1971, after Richard Nixon closed the gold window. And terrible inflation.
And because we know what happened after that, because after Nixon closed the coal window, we ended up about 1979 with inflation 15-16%. They had to get interest rates up to, what, over 20% to try to preserve the dollar.
That's right. But the thinking in Washington appears to be, in fact, I've had people in Washington tell me this, that the dollar doesn't matter. Neither does the deficit. And so as they go along and they run into problems, the first thing they look at is the deficit. We don't need to worry about that. The second thing is the dollar. Well, we can sacrifice that. Problem is, we can't. And both of those are, both the dollar and the deficit are at a critical point, and one which threatens to throw us into what I'll refer to as a hyperinflationary Great Depression.
Well, of course, the thing about the debt is that you can sort of inflate that away. In other words, if you have inflation, then that you have a national debt, say, of for round figures, of $9 trillion. But, of course, that amount in real purchasing dollars goes down every year, because if you're having an inflation rate, you know, as much as 14%, why, of course, you're then really in real value, the deficit would only be $8 trillion next year and $7 trillion the next year, you know, in real purchasing value.
Well, it even gets a lot worse than that, because the one thing you'll find, despite all the shenanigans that go on in Washington, and this is on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats alike. Excuse me. The when something is done with the numbers, usually it's written about, it's footnoted. They're fairly straightforward about it. They may not give it a lot of publicity, but if you look for it, you can find what's happening. And back in the late 70s, what were then the top 10, or the Big Ten accounting firms, got together with the government and said, hey, let's create an accounting system that will put you on a par with corporate America. And they have now put that in effect, and they have what they call generally accepted accounting principle, effective accounting. The total obligations of the federal government today are over $50 trillion.
Let me repeat that. The total obligations of the federal government, over $50 trillion. If we use the accounting methods, we require every individual company to do. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. I think people really have to understand what this means as far as everything they have denominated in dollars.
Well, we're going to get into that.
Well, we're going to get into that in just a moment here. But I think it's so vitally important people understand that their pensions, their insurance policies, their annuity, their CDs, their bonds, everything they have is in jeopardy. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is John Williams. We're talking about the what's going on as far as the economy is concerned. So please go ahead and pick up your discussion.
Well, using these, and this is a recent phenomenon. I think it's since 2001. U.S. Treasury has had to publish financial statements using the same broad accounting principles used by corporate America. Now, the Treasury publishes this statement every year. It's signed by the Secretary of the Treasury. It is audited by the, used to be the General Accounting Office. Now they call themselves the Government Accountability Office. But the Comptroller General signs off on it. He won't certify the statement because there's so many problems with the government's reporting. But using the generally accepted accounting principle, what you'll find is that the deficit for last year was $4.6 trillion. That compares with something in the 200 billion range that they used as the official number. Not, and I'm talking trillions, not billions, $4.6 trillion. To put that into perspective, if, let's say, the government wanted to cover that with taxes, government could take 100% of wages, salaries, and corporate profits, and they'd still be in deficit. It has gotten to the point that this is beyond containment. The other way of approaching it, of course, is to significantly slash Social Security and Medicare programs, which are the primary unfunded programs in this mess. And there's no one in Washington who would be willing to address that. So I see it basically as not only... uncontained, but it's actually getting worse. If you look at most of the presidential candidates out there, they're all coming up with big spending programs, new health systems, whatever. The government does not have the money. If you go back to 2004, the real deficit that year had been going around $3.5 trillion a year, jumped to over $11 trillion. The reason it jumped to over $11 trillion was because the new Medicare system was put into effect. But it was unfunded to the extent of about $8 trillion. Can you imagine that? The Congress put it into effect knowing that the system was not funded, could not be funded, and that there was a shortfall. When I say shortfall, what they do in the accounting here is they look at this.
Hold that thought. Just for a moment. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking with John Williams. But before we go on, Mr. Williams, I'd like you to get out your webpage or any other information you'd like to get out. So if people would like to get your work, they'd be able to.
Sure. I have a website at www.shadowstats.com. That's S-H-A-D-O-W. S-T-A-T-S.
That's S-H-A-D-O-W-S-T-A-T-S, shadowstats.com. Go ahead.
And what you'll find there, upper right-hand corner, we have a series of articles giving you background on government's economic reporting, the key series, the budget deficit reality, and links to the Treasury financial statements. We also have available in our archives all the newsletters that are more than 6 months old. On our alternate data page, you can see graphs of what we currently estimate is happening with the CPI, the GDP. We have alternate measures of the dollar. We show what's happening with the money supply, M3. And for anyone who's actually interested in subscribing, we're always happy to pick up a subscriber, and the subscribers get the current outlook. But there's a lot of information there that brings you up to speed as to what's happening.
Well, I think it's important during the break, Mr. Williams, for simply pointing out that we were told that, gee, things are really looking better, that, the debt for this last year was about $240 billion. The truth of the matter is, if you use proper accounting techniques, it was really $4.6 trillion, or something very close to that. It's trillion, not billion dollars. In other words, there is simply no way, of course, that if the government was to tax everybody 100% of their income, they still couldn't come up with the $4.6 trillion that we really needed to fund the liabilities that were accrued last year.
And that's one year alone.
Right. Of course, people have no idea that they are setting us up for the greatest catastrophe of all time. And Mr. Williams was pointing out, John was pointing out, that they had passed the Medicare drug bill, which was going to cost $11 trillion with no funding for it. It's wonderful when you're a politician and you can get all sorts of perks for yourself, and that you give away such all sorts of money so you get reelected. And then, of course, you're going to retire, and you're going to get your retirement probably indexed so that, you'll always be able to have health care. But, of course, you're going to leave everybody else destitute, because of what we've pointed out is that for the average individual out there, if you have money, it's going to be destroyed. They're going to destroy the value of your pension fund, your insurance policy, your annuities, your CDs, your savings. The life savings of these people is being destroyed by inflation. And the trouble is that they know exactly what they're doing, but they're trying to keep the people from learning. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes. Indeed, they know exactly what they're doing. I've talked with people in Washington, and they say, well, the problem's here. They're too far down the road. We don't have to worry about them now. You're dealing with people that have a mindset where the furthest planning horizon they have is the next election, which at most is 2 years off. Corporate America is dealing in an environment where their planning horizon is 3 months off, the next quarter. You do have people like David Walker, who's the Comptroller General. He's out talking about what's happening here. These numbers are out of the U.S. Treasury. But the press doesn't pick up on it, and I'll tell you why the press doesn't, and we'll get to that in a minute. But what happens here, effectively, the U.S. government is bankrupt. Governments generally don't go bankrupt. I mean, some do, but usually the course they take is, as you suggested, they rev up the printing presses and just pay everyone off, and the currency becomes worthless. And what we'll see here eventually, not immediately, but it will come, is a hyperinflation. And when I say hyperinflation, there are all sorts of definitions of it, but if you look back to what happened in the Weimar Republic in Germany after World War I, it'd be similar to that. And there's an image there that I always thought was rather interesting, and it's the one I use to define a hyperinflation, and please excuse me if it's a little crude, but when the largest denomination bill, in this case a $100 bill that's in circulation, before the hyperinflation hits, becomes worth more as functional toilet paper than as currency, you have a hyperinflation.
Well, of course, in Rhodesia today, the official inflation rate is 13,000% a year, but the real inflation rate is probably 20,000 to 30,000% a year. And remember, that is the government that was installed by our State Department over the objection of the Rhodesian people. But of course, Henry Kissinger promised the people of what we refer to today as Zimbabwe, that if anything happened that was bad back there, there was any breakdown of law and order, that America would be there to help. They could depend on America. We would be there.
Right.
And what 25 years ago was a stable currency, with actually it took three American dollars to buy one Rhodesian dollar. Today, of course, the average pension is 700 Rhodesian dollars, which would buy two slices of bread for an entire month. That's the situation that your State Department has created. And so Henry Kissinger, who is still one of the major advisors to the administration, brought that to Rhodesia. What are they planning for America? People say it could never happen here. Well, how would you respond to that?
It's actually going to be worse, because what we're going to see here is that the dollar will become virtually worthless. One last example from the Weimar Republic. There are images there that people. It helps to hear them or envision them because it gives you an idea of what you're really looking at here. You could go into a fine restaurant, order a very expensive bottle of wine, and the next morning, that empty bottle would be worth more than it was the night before, filled with wine, as scrap glass.
In other words, it was just the rapid rise of the increase in inflation.
Yes, it's, as you say, it destroys pensions, anything that's cash denominated or where there's a fixed amount that's promised to you in the future, including Social Security. That's why it'll happen. But the I was going to get into why the press doesn't talk about this.
Why doesn't the press talk about it?
Because basically, Wall Street buys a lot of advertising space, and Wall Street doesn't want to talk about it. Some years back, actually it was 1989, we're going into the 1990 recession at the time, and I was on CNBC to debate whether or not we were going into recession with an economist from a major New York City bank. Before the show, we're sitting and talking in what they call the green room. And he asked me what I think's happening. I tell him we're heading into a major recession, going to be fairly protracted and deep. He said, yes, I think that's the consensus. Well, that really shocked me because I was not aware of any consensus. That's what was happening. But he knew very well what was happening. We get on the air. I gave my pitch on why we're heading into recession. And he said, oh, we've got a booming economy in the year ahead. And very simply, he had to present his company's sales pitch.
Well, now, what about the economy now? Of course, we hear, read the papers, they tell us really the economy is pretty good. A lot of the corporations are making good money, and so really, of course, we shouldn't be discouraged. Certainly may have a little rise in unemployment. I thought it was so amazing. In the month of August, they reported there was a loss of 4,000 jobs. Then about 4 weeks later, they said, whoops, oh, we made a mistake. It was really we gained 89,000 jobs. How could you make a mistake one day? We lost 4,000. I mean, 4 weeks later, we actually gained 89,000. Talking about the same time period.
Yeah, well, this is... there are two types of manipulations that you have with the data. One is a long-term where there are methodological changes, such as redefining discouraged workers. Then you have the times when there are very specific manipulations that are done. And I think we just saw one. A month ago, there was some question whether or not the Fed was going to ease. Bernanke was very nervous about easing because, or going at least beyond what he had effectively already done, because he was allowing the federal funds rate to trade at that point a 0.25% below where the target was.
No, because he was talking about, of course, the major worry is inflation. We're worried about inflation. Well, we may even have to tighten, and then all of a sudden, instead of tightening, they're raising the interest rates, they lower the interest rate, and not a quarter point, but a half point.
Yeah, well, what happened was the administration massaged those early August employment numbers to basically force the Fed into an easing, to make it look like the economy was in recession, which it is. It is in recession, no question on that. But to actually show it in the statistics.
You mean you think that they actually gave the Fed phony figures to try to get them, of course, to then lower the interest rates?
Yes, I think Mr. Bernanke needs a little bit of encouragement there. And it was my speculation. I don't have any hard evidence. Just a matter of reading the circumstantial evidence.
I mean, it's pretty hard to go from a loss of 4,000 to a gain of 89,000.
Well, not when you had the reaction that the Fed had to its big easing, which was heavy selling of the dollar. And that's where the problem is now for the Fed, is the concern for the dollar.
But, of course, the dollar is in real trouble. The dollar certainly has fallen almost, what, 40% over the last 3 years?
That sounds about right. It is, let me put it this way, it is, well, it's down, it's half its value of 20 years ago. It's been up and down, but it's been falling off sharply. Recently, gold has been rallying counter to that. And where the problem is for the dollar and for the U.S. markets, and where this may eventually actually accelerate the hyperinflation process, is that aside from the budget deficit, we also have an extraordinary trade deficit. And if you ever want to get into issues as to why the standard of living has dropped in the last 30 years, it's generally tied to the trade, but with the trade deficit, it's been so large that rather than cash in the dollars, the foreign and foreign central banks have been buying dollars. Have been buying U.S. Treasury securities through the Federal Reserve. The effect has been that for the last 3-4 years, effectively, the influx of dollars from the foreign central banks has covered our net issuance of new debt from the U.S. Treasury. The foreigners have paid for our new issuance. As long as they keep doing that, everything may be just fine and dandy, but if they stop doing it, which they appear to be doing, and you've had countries such as China threaten to actually dump the dollar, you're in a circumstance right now where the U.S. markets have been very heavily dependent on that foreign capital for liquidity. And if that dries up, two things happen. One, interest rates spike, and the stock market sells off very sharply. And Mr. Bernanke knows this. And one thing that has triggered some of the recent dollar selling was the magnitude of that last easing. So getting back to, now it's up 89,000. I think that was a signal, okay, maybe we shouldn't have gone as far as we did the last time with the easing. Let's pull back, take some of the pressure off the Fed because they're afraid of what's going to happen with the dollar and its impact on the market.
Well, what's going to happen to the retired people in this country, if the dollar keeps decreasing in value?
Well, what happens is you're losing your purchasing power against the rest of the world. If you look at the, if you go ahead a year from now, and let's say you had some assets in Swiss francs, basically cash in Swiss francs, and the dollar drops 30% against the Swiss franc, which I think it's a possibility that could happen, but I'm just using this as an example. If the stock market were up, let's say, 10% over the next year, which I don't think is going to happen, but let's say it were, you could, at the end of the year, look at that and say, boy, I was smart to be in the stock market. Look, I'm up 10%. But the guy in Switzerland who did the same thing says, gee, what a terrible investment I made. I'm down 20% because the U.S. stock market's denominated in dollars. Now, if a U.S. investor put his money into the Swiss franc, he'd be up 30%, up 20%. I'm using very round numbers here. But he's effectively gained 20% more than the stock market. And he said, boy, I'm a real genius. I'm up 20% more than the stock market. Unfortunately, that fellow, he had his cash in Swiss francs. But what he doesn't realize is that all he did was maintain the purchasing power of his dollars against the rest of the world instead of losing 30%, which everyone else who had all their assets denominated in dollars did. And it's a very silent drainer of real wealth. But the decline in the value of the dollar, people say, hey, it doesn't matter. It does matter if you're looking at the purchasing power of your net assets, your wealth.
Well, it looks to me as if an awful lot of elderly people, people on fixed incomes, are going to be just impoverished.
And unfortunately, that's a likely outcome of this. It's a terrible thing to say, but...
But of course, somebody has to warn people that they've got to get involved, they've got to understand what we're talking about. Somebody has to sound the clarion call, certainly David Walker from the General Accountability Office, and anybody can Google his name in, David Walker, G-A-O, and read what he says about the fact that we are bankrupt. There's a doctor, Professor Kitlikoff, who's done an article for the St. Louis branch of the Federal Reserve. A professor, I forgot where he's at, what university he's at, but he certainly says essentially the same thing.
Yes. No, this is, the information is there, and it's published by the U.S. Treasury. But Wall Street, the financial media, do not pick up on it. It's bad news. Nobody likes bad news because it doesn't sell the financial product. It causes people to sell their financial.
But because people have to protect themselves, because certainly the bureaucrats aren't going to do that. They're going to have their income will be certainly indexed to the rate of inflation. And it won't hurt the congressmen. Well, they're going to be able to vote themselves the raises and pay, and their income will be certainly accurately rated to inflation. But the average individual out here, of course, is going to be left to fend for themselves, especially those who are dependent upon Social Security and Medicare. Well, our guest this evening has been John Williams from ShadowStats.com. That's ShadowStats.com. We'll be right back to wrap up the program. Well, we have 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program, Mr. John.
Okay.
You go right ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. What we've seen here over the last 30 years, actually since the days of Franklin Roosevelt, has been a series of actions taken by the federal government and politicians to buy votes and to slowly debase the value of the dollar. That pace is accelerating. The dollar is now within a horizon where you can see it becoming absolutely worthless. For people who have their assets denominated in dollars, I would look to own a little bit of gold, if possible, to maybe even look to get some currency outside the dollar. Don't count on Social Security if you're not already receiving it. It's a doomed program.
In fact, the first baby boomers start retiring next year.
Yeah, and that's why it's the system's bankrupt. The only person who's going to save you here is yourself. You have to use common sense and look at ways of approaching this and be creative in how you protect your future.
And people really have to understand that they've tried these fiat money systems many times before, as old as ancient Rome and ancient Greece, and they never worked there, and they're not going to work here, no matter how smart Alan Greenspan says he is.
He's a very good politician, never much of an economist as far as I'm concerned, but that's an entire show in itself.
Well, maybe we can actually do a show on that sometime in the future. It's been fascinating this evening, and I certainly want to thank you for taking the time to be with us. And I think that the major thing is for get people thinking, I'm going to have to look after myself. I'm going to have to do something to protect, you know, what I've worked my entire life for, because, of course, the politicians are out to destroy the value of our currency and undermine the very fabric of our way of life. So, anyway, John, thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you, Stan. It's been a pleasure being with you.
All right, fine. Well, thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. And, of course, I think the major thing that you want to get out of the program this evening is that the M3 figures, which reflect future inflation right now, over 14% a year. And the fact that you're not hearing this reflects the degree of control over what the American people think. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly, as you may suspect, why John and I talk during the breaks. And if you'd like to get the complete program, it's available to Radio Liberty by just calling us at 1-800-544-8927. But the important thing to understand is the government has stopped publishing M3 figures, which, of course, is the overall amount of Duke money and credit they're creating throughout the world. And that figure is running over 14% at the present time, a prelude to hyperinflation and the destruction of course, your life savings. So what you really need to do is begin to understand these figures. So if you want to go to my website at RadioLiberty.com and read my last two newsletters, Financial Collapse of Part 1, Part 2, Part 3 will be up before long, and we have, I think, one more to go in this series. And then let me suggest my talk on Financial Tsunami. It's available in DVD or video, and it comes with a syllabus which we recommend people get. It will introduce you to these terms and how you can begin to understand the money stock and how the people at the Federal Reserve talk, because they talk in something called Fed speak, and that is, it is designed to confuse you common people because you're not smart enough to understand what the elite were doing and really don't want you to know. Their loyalty is not to the United States. They are traitors to this country. They are dedicated to globalism, to a one-world order, to a one-world religion, and, of course, a new world leader. And if you doubt that is their objective, you can go to the Lucius Trust website. It used to be the Lucifer Publishing House, but you can go to their website, or certainly you can get some of our material, that the pamphlet on the spiritual hierarchy put out by the Lucius Trust, where they freely talk about the beings from the other dimension who are really directing what's going on in the world today. But go to LuciusTrust.org, I believe it is, or com, LuciusTrust, L-U-C-I-S, and understand this is not imaginary, it's real, and some of the most wealthy people in the world are aligned with the Lucius Trust. Let me suggest, for more information on what's going on financially, my little pamphlet entitled The History of Money, What You Should Know. That's The History of Money, What You Should Know. The book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. The book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and A Fiat Money Inflation in France. Those three books, along with my talk on the financial tsunami, will give you the background, and a little pamphlet on the history of money will give you the background that you need at least to begin to making some preparations for your survival, because believe me, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't look after yourself, nobody's going to. There are people in Washington who have a different agenda. What they want to do is redistribute your wealth. The plan is laid out in the Earth Charter, and if you haven't read it, it's available on the Internet, or we'll send you a free copy. It's written by some of the most powerful people in the world. It is kept in the Ark of Hope, which is the Luciferian counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant. Because this whole thing is a Luciferian plan. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to hear our talk. It's available on DVD, titled The Forbidden Secret. The Forbidden Secret. I could suggest our four-tape set, or four-CD set, The Secret Behind the Secret. Now, of course, this deals with Rhonda Byrne's DVD, The Secret, and her book, The Secret, which has been popularized by Oprah Winfrey and by Larry King and by Jim Carrey and by Ellen DeGeneres, is The Secret to Life, and they're going to tell it to you. And they're absolutely right. There is a secret out there. It's been passed down for 5,000 years, and it will give you great power and influence, but do not, under any circumstances, access that power, because, of course, it is not of this earth or this world. It comes from the other dimension, and you risk your eternal soul. But understand, this is not imaginary. This is one of the most popular books and CDs in America. It's called The Secret, and we will tell you the secret behind the secret. Remember our all-day seminar on the 28th of October here in the Monterey Bay area. You'll need a reservation. If you can come, great lineup of guests. That's October 28th, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, and we're going to have Ron Brown there talking about financial matters, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in a battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for this next hour, the views of Barry Shamish. And Barry is an investigative reporter who is, of course, was an Israeli, and he's worked for many years over there exposing the murder of Rabin, who was the prime minister or premier of Israel. And he was actually killed, of course, by their own intelligence agencies or police agencies, and the story that was told to the public was false. And Barry was eventually able to convince the majority, probably almost 50% of the Israeli people, of the truth of the fact that their prime minister had been assassinated by people in his own government. And of course, then Chris Barry was on the top of so many other fascinating stories. But because he was exposing so much in the way of corruption, his life was in danger, and he's come to the United States, where he's now living at the present time, but still keeping us advised of what's going on in Israel, because I believe that what is happening in Israel is the key to what is going to happen in the world. So, Barry, without further ado, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Okay, fine. Well, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Oh, it's just endless. Really, you know, you called me this morning, and there wasn't a lot of time, and I was a bit busy, and so I turned on the computer, and then before you know it, there's so much anger and in Israel, and there's so much emotion about the few people left in Israel who care, that there's plenty to talk about. The first thing, though, the business about Rabin, a very important poll. The anniversary of Rabin is about coming up, and every year the same poll always takes place. Do you believe Rabin was killed in a conspiracy? That's the big question. And this year, the newspaper Mariv decided to beat out the competition and ask that question just a little ahead of Rabin's assassination. And here are the results for this year. They asked it, by the way, in two groups. One, general population, which, of course, includes Arabs. Two, religious, which I assume only includes Jews. Nonetheless, in the general population, the question was, do you believe Yigal Amir is innocent of the murder of Yitzhak Rabin? 28% of the regular population said yes, he is innocent. 46% of the religious said yes, he is innocent. Now, 46, of course, is the usual half, but the general population is a little more interesting because they include the Arabs as 20%. So what you've got to do is you've got to add about 20%, because the Arabs know nothing but the Rabin assassination. And all of them are going to say that Yigal Amir killed Rabin. They don't know anything else. Well, the figure is about the same for religious and secular when you do that. What it comes down to is, according to Mariv, about 46% of the Israeli people believe that the Rabin murder was a setup.
And I think that, Gush, can already be attributed largely to your work, your books, your videos, the things you've been putting out through the years to try to expose what was going on. And
95.6% is attributed to me.
Oh, well, congratulations, but we've known that for a long time, and you're to be commended for your effort to try to get the truth out. But, ladies and gentlemen, so often when leaders of the country are assassinated, it is truly a coup d'etat. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, I guess we should mention a very, very terrible thing that happened in Israel. Like, like that's brand new. It's actually at the point now that we're not talking about my particular emotions. We're talking about the nation's emotions, but they're suppressing it in Israel. They're waiting for the worst. And I guess it's human nature that when you wait for the worst, you don't see it in front of your nose. But there was really a dreadful event that took place, three, 4 days ago, that's all, where a town called Netivot, Keren Shalom as well, there were two towns, but Netivot's a big town, and it's about 11 kilometers from the Gaza border, was hit by a brand new missile, a brand new kind of missile. It's called a GRAD, G-R-A-D. Now, I've been saying this for a long, long time, that the Hamas have got medium-range missiles, and when they finally hit Israel, it's not going to be the town of Sderot, which is literally a mile from the Gaza Strip. It's not even difficult to hit Sderot. Netivot's a little different. That's 11 kilometers, and Keren Shalom is a bit longer. Nonetheless, a brand new town was hit that had never been hit before, and it was hit by a medium-range missile.
Was there very much damage done?
Yeah, tons. One whole house was collapsed. No one died. I guess that's the worst damage of all. But yeah, it was nasty. It hit a house, destroyed it. In short, it's not even an issue really of the damage. It's an issue that was done. The key here, and there's a lot of keys, but the point is this was not a Qassam. It was not a homemade pipe bomb. Israel from the Gaza Strip was hit by a GRAD, which is a type of Katyusha. It is actually a Katyusha. It's a Russian-made medium-range missile with a lot more armaments on it than a Qassam. It's got a lot more bombs attached to it. And, well, it came out of Gaza. Now, what that means...
Hold that stuff right there, Barry. Okay. We'll be back in just a moment as we bring other stations on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is simply talking about what's happened in Israel here. Just very recently, a town 11 kilometers from the border with Gaza. Remember, of course, that the Israeli government had turned Gaza over to the radicals, the Palestinian terrorists, and had forced the Israelis that lived there, many of them 30 years or more, to leave their homes at no compensation. 10,000 of them forced to leave, turning that over to the Palestinian terrorists so they could use that as a base for bombarding Israel, which doesn't make sense. And there's a town right about a kilometer from the border, Sderot, who's been getting quite a pounding recently, but now suddenly they're getting much more sophisticated weapons. Hamas launched this very sophisticated missile, and of course it hit this town. What people don't understand is that Hamas is getting lots of Soviet-made missiles, as is Hezbollah, and of course, there are really tens of thousands of missiles in the immediate area, all aimed at Israel. And, of course, there's no way that they're all launched at once, especially if there are missiles launched from Syria as well, that Israel could survive an intense bombardment because it's such a small community. Not only that, but thanks to the defense minister, they've taken the gas masks away from so many of the Israelis. So if there are chemical or biological weapons used, which I believe there will be in the next attack, the Israelis will have no means to protect themselves and their families. Go right ahead.
Well, it's not a good thing to say I told you so when something is so bad, but I told you so. This is an issue that the Qassams, which supposedly Israel has been laughing off, that so what, we had to abandon one town, Sderot, it's not so bad, we've got plenty of towns. And I said, nah, it's not just Sderot. And Shrut, by the way, is an Israeli town. You defend it with all your heart and soul because they're your citizens. And that, of course, wasn't done. And the old Israel would never, ever have allowed a town of its to disappear. But what this means is they've got a weapon that can hit Ashkelon. Now, Ashkelon is about 11 kilometers from the Gaza Strip. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in Israel that we'll cut off your electricity. If these rockets don't stop flying, we'll cut off your power. Because Israel actually controls Gaza's power. Now, on paper, that sounds like a terrific idea. We're going to cut off your power until you stop sending missiles on your border and making life impossible in Shderot, and it sounds terrific, except for one thing. They get the power from the Ashkelon generating plants. Now, what I've been telling people is very straightforward. If Gaza's power is cut off, there are missiles inside Gaza that can knock out the Ashkelon power plants. And those missiles, it turns out to be, are Grads. Grad, as I said, is a Russian Katyusha, which, by the way, is not a wayward rocket like the Kassam. They are an aimed rocket. They'll more or less land where you send it. In such a case, the Ashkelon power plant comes under tremendous rocket attack, and there you have 40% of Israel's power comes out of the Ashkelon power plant. The Gaza has the ability to cut off the power to 40% of Israel with the right missile. The Grad apparently is the right missile. The Grad was launched at Netivot. The Grad was launched just... Now, look, the Arabs don't shoot, expose their hand this way unless there is a darn good reason. They're sending a little message with every rocket. They're sending a little message. In this case, we're talking about this dreadful Bush administration soiree in Washington or Annapolis, Maryland. They've now named the site of this conference in November to be Annapolis, Maryland. And suddenly, and this is sudden, Mahmoud Abbas, the so-called leader of the Palestinians, he's in fact the leader of nobody, has announced that he will not be coming. Now, the reason why he wouldn't be coming is Israel did not give in. It's that simple. Israel did not give in on refugees. Israel did not give in on Judea and Samaria. It wants to keep 2%, where like 300,000 people live. It wants to keep that 2% and instead offered a little land in the Negev instead of all of Judea and Samaria. Israel, well, it's certainly given up and agreed to give up all of Jerusalem, but I guess they want to keep the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem where, oh, I don't know, about 5,000 or 6,000 Jews live today. The point is, whatever the reason is, it's all phony. For some reason, the PLO does not want to show up in Washington because they believe they can wipe out Israel. Why go and sign something and be made to look foolish when you actually believe a war is coming up and you're going to win that war? The PLO don't want to go to George Bush's grand party in Washington coming up. And there's got to be a darn good reason why they don't want to show up for what is going to be an ambush of Israel. And that reason has got to be they know Israel's going to lose the next war. Now, this is complicated stuff because the Arabs, there are Arabs inside Israel. It's not as if Arabs won't be hurt, but I guess the Arabs just don't care. In order to defeat Israel at any price, they will wound a bunch and kill a bunch of Arabs. but they're going to destroy Israel. And this is the Arab world, to the Arab world, that is immensely important. And I guess the Arabs believe they have a better chance at war than they do with the phony peace of George Bush. But for some reason, the PLO have decided that they don't like so far what Ehud Olmert is giving them, which, by the way, is exactly what the defense minister, Ehud Barak, in the year 2000 offered them, which is all the West Bank, all of Eastern Jerusalem, all the Holy Temple Mount, all of Gaza, all the Jordan Valley, everything. But it's still not good enough for them. So the war option must be an extremely likely way to win back Israel and keep their pride and keep Palestinian pride. And it's probably more dangerous for them to be a nation the way George Bush has offered them. It may be worse for their nationalism than to keep fighting for Israel. But one thing is for certain, they now have the weaponry. They now have the missiles to start hitting the major cities of Israel's western coast from the Gaza Strip. And that's why the town of Netivot, which was hit by the Grad missiles, says the next war is not going to be a few Qassams, and it's just not going to be Sderot. It's going to be a war where the Gaza Strip can cause a lot of damage to Israel's main population centers.
Well, now, when was this meeting supposed to be in Washington, D.C.?
They haven't named a date. They've said mid-November.
All right.
So my guess is between the 15th and 20th, but it's they did name the participants. And once again, I turn on my little computer, and it's all over the Internet who's invited to this Bush party. It's not just the Arabs and Israel. It includes the G8. Every member of the G8 gets to come to this conference for some reason. It involves the Arab League, like 24 Arab countries are invited to this conference. In short, Israel is going to be ganged up upon from every corner and from every angle. Poor little Israel is going to be pounced on at this Bush conference. But there won't be much reason if the PLO doesn't show up. Right now, the PLO is saying, we have not got enough from Israel. We still want more. Which ultimately means, all of the West Bank, all of Eastern Jerusalem, everything the Israelis are hedging on by like 1 or 2%. And by the way, I use the word Israelis, meaning their government. The Israeli people don't like this one little bit. But nonetheless, the core of the matter is that in Gaza, they have the ability to damage Israel. And this week, Israelis woke up to find out that actually two new towns, Keren Shalom, was also hit. Now, the Shabak has given the Israeli people, believe it or not, this is considered a semi-hopeful picture. The Shabak says that all the grads, or the Katyushas, were smuggled in from Egypt, which means, of course, that, as I have been saying on this show, for the longest time, Israel should be at official war with Egypt, because Egypt is in an official state of war with Israel. But Israelis still think they have a peace treaty signed by Sadat and Begin there. They're wrong.
And, of course, America has been giving Egypt about $3 billion a year that they've been using to get the weapons that they're going to be able to use with Israel. They've been building the roads so that it'll be easier for their tanks to get to Israel and their armored personnel carriers. We've been providing their military hardware financially for Egypt in preparation for what I believe is going to be one of the final great battles in that area. Why would we be funding Egypt? Why would we be giving money that eventually gets in the hands of Hamas? Why would we be actually transferring technology to Russia that it uses to build weapons that will be used against Israel and against the American forces if we go into Iran? Doesn't make sense. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, I've got a bunch of topics that I just looked at from this terrible week. Again, it was not an atypical week. You phoned me this morning, and things are tight, and time is tight. So I sent you. Did you receive a letter from me about Israel's nuclear option?
No. I did not get it. If you did send it, must have been sent later in the day, because I didn't get on my computer after early this morning. So
now, in that case, I'll just go over the main issue.
All right, go ahead.
I have a friend who for many, many years has helped me. His family was high up in the Mossad. His father was high up in the Mossad. This person helped me immensely with the Rabin assassination. And he said, you have to put this out, send it to your group. Now, I sent that analysis out to you. It's essentially my analysis of the trouble we're in. He agrees with everything. Israel is surrounded by missiles. It's overwhelmed by missiles up to, 60,000. And he wrote about the Israeli atomic option. And he analyzed it in terms of what was believed and what is the truth. Israel used the MAD, the American-Russian system.
Mutual assured destruction.
Mm-hmm. And he says, well, that has nothing to do with the Middle East. Nothing whatsoever. Because the Middle East has suicide bombers. And Russia never had suicide bombers. And the Middle East believes that if you destroy Israel, you have a better paradise awaiting you. And there are many nations based on this belief that if you destroy Israel, everything will be better no matter what the cost. And he says Israel has a total of between 200 and 500 nuclear weapons. And it's got 3 submarines equipped with the nuclear weapons. He gave me this big long analysis of what Israel could do. Then he gave me an analysis of what the Arabs could do. Israel has a shield, a missile shield, and he says it could knock down, possibly. There would be a lot of leaks, and there would be a lot of missiles getting through, but at its best, it could knock down 200 to 500 missiles coming into Israel. It could not handle tens of thousands. It would be overwhelmed. Now, I've been saying this all along, and all through these many fine months that I've been on your show, Israel can't take a bombardment. Now, suddenly, forget his name. I know his name, and I sent you the letter, and you'll look at it tomorrow.
All right, go ahead.
But the fact is, Israel cannot withstand a massive bombardment. And he gave the scenario of what would happen. Israel would send planes to Iran. Let's say Iran bombarded them with a nuclear weapon. Let's say. But nonetheless, those planes would not be able to land back in Israel because Israel would be destroyed. He said the submarines can knock off Cairo and Alexander, but they'll have no base to return to when they finish their mission. He said,
hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment.
Hold
that thought.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and basically Barry is talking about the Samson option, or the nuclear option that Israel would have. And certainly Israel has a number of atom bombs. We don't know. The figure could be between 200 and 500. It has planes that are capable of flying to Iran and dropping nuclear weapons. But by the time those planes got back to Israel, there'd be nothing there, because Israel and the airfields and the Israeli land would be destroyed by the bombardment by the Arabs. Certainly Israel has 3 submarines, and it has cruise missiles that are nuclear tipped, certainly, and those submarines could certainly knock out Alexandria and Cairo. And but, of course, they would have no place to go back, because Israel as a nation would cease to exist. We're talking about a terrible nuclear war. I mean, the sort of war that everybody has been frightened to death about, but people are beginning to talk about this as an option today. So pick up the story there, Barry.
Well, the main problem I have with this is I've been saying it, but I just happen to use the word nuclear. It's a small landscape, Israel. It doesn't matter if it's nuclear or conventional. Now, he gave me, we could say a secret Mossad overview of the situation, that Israel is so small that in any nuclear war it would be destroyed, and the Arab world, it would hurt from an Israeli nuclear attack. Let's say it will hurt, but Israel will be destroyed on the first day, and the nuclear stubs and the airplanes will return to absolutely nothing. Israel will not, in fact, exist. Anyone who survives that place literally won't survive as a nation. It will be gone. Now, I don't want to necessarily write this out because all he's done is taken my general synopsis of what a war would do and simply add nuclear to it, why bother? I know all this, but it does come from someone who knows the Israeli Defense Initiative, and he says there is no Samson option whatsoever, simply because Israel will not exist and the Arabs will exist. Maybe they won't exist in any form, but Israel will be gone and all its people will be gone. And this to me is not news. The news part is it's such an intense analysis of what would happen in a mad war. In this mad war, it's not Russia, United States. It is a destroyed Israel and a wounded Arabs. And he says the Israeli Samson option will not be used because the Israeli nation in a war like that will cease to exist. 5.5 million Jews will be slaughtered. And he says it doesn't add up. What good is the nuclear option? Israel can't win a nuclear war. If it came down to Iran getting nukes, Israel would not be able to win it anyways. So what they're doing, he claims, according to this report, is they're giving up right now because this greatest so-called deterrence, the nuclear deterrence, is essentially of no value to the country whatsoever. And this is the report I sent to you. You'll be able to read it. In an insane world against really, really insane Arabs who don't have the Russian and American viewpoint that destruction of anybody is a tragedy, Israel will lose if it turns to a Samson option. So I guess from that point of view, maybe it's worthy of being read. But we'll decide within a day or two if I put it out or not. But it came from a source within the Israeli security services, intelligence services, that they're better off selling out the country piece by piece and little by little than actually depending on its so-called strength, because the so-called strength won't work.
Well, of course, the thing is, of course, if what you're talking about is a logical world, and I certainly agree with you from a purely logical point of view, everything you've said is true. Unfortunately, we don't live in a logical world. I mean, if we were living in a logical world, we wouldn't be over fighting in Afghanistan. We wouldn't be over fighting in Iraq. The United States wouldn't be even considering going to war with Iran. This is organized madness. But, of course, as you see what's going on in the world today, so much of what's going on is organized madness. And somehow, I believe it's within God's providence that Israel is really the key to everything that's going on today in the Near East and the Middle East. We'll be right back in just a moment with Barry Shemesh. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is is Barry Shamish. We're talking about the Samson option, and there are people within Israeli intelligence and within certainly the think tanks over there in Israel who say, look, you know, if we were to use the Samson option, certainly Israel would be destroyed. The Arab countries would be badly damaged, but, you know, they would at least survive to some extent. And so really, we're better off almost to make any concession now to avoid war. The problem is that you're dealing with people who will never accept Israel's existence there. And although there may be some enlightened Arab leaders that say, well, let's make peace and just see if we can't get along with the Jews and let them have that little sliver of land along the edge of the Mediterranean. And but, of course, there are other Muslims who say no. Every last Jew is going to have to be destroyed. And unfortunately, there are people within the radical Islamic movement who feel exactly that way. So pick up the story there. Where do we go from here, Barry?
Well, we go to the horrible and truthful example that Olmert, as we know, is prepared to divide Jerusalem. And we've been getting these leaks from the Arabs themselves for long enough. But the fact is, he's got horrible allies. And one is the near pedophile Chaim Ramon, who not 5 months ago sat in court for sticking his tongue down an 18-year-old soldier's throat, and actually became the third highest minister in the government. After Tzipi Livni comes Chaim Ramon. He has now got a plan to divide Jerusalem. And he is loudly proclaiming that East Jerusalem has got to go, but he's got a new ally from the Israeli right, who I've been saying for years is a crook, and he's all tied up with the Russian mafia. He lives in the West Bank, by the way, in a place called Tekoa. That is Avigdor Lieberman, who agrees that Jerusalem has got to be divided. So now you've got the far right gone. There is no one else in the Knesset representing the far right. Like, by the way, the second largest power in the Knesset, third largest, I'm sorry, is Bataille's Rhodes' party, is Avigdor Lieberman's party, is now in favor of dividing Jerusalem. As of this week, the Israeli government has announced when it comes to Washington, it will agree to divide Jerusalem. And
hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with Barry Shavit. Well, this is Dr. Stan in Sydney. Barry is saying that that Olmert and many of the leaders of the current Israeli government are prepared to divide Jerusalem and give half it to the Arabs. And this is the last thing that the Israeli people want. But the leadership are intent upon the betrayal of the Israeli people. And since the opposition, both the conservative and the liberal elements there, are actually controlled by the globalists, there is no opposition to these plans. Before we go on, Barry, I would like you to get out your webpage and how people can get in touch with you and get your books.
Well, that's very kind of you. Well, tonight we haven't really talked about the consequences of abandoning Gaza, except that Gaza was where Jewish villages once stood, was the rocket launching ground for the grads that had Netivot and Keren Shalom, by the way. For some reason, that is considered less of a disaster. Netivot is considered a disaster because of its distance from the Gaza Strip. But if you want to know how Israel did give up Gaza, read my book, Bye Bye Gaza. And to do so is really simple. You go to www.lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. You write in my name in the right-hand corner. It says search. You write C-H-A-M-I-S-H. That's Shamish. And you will find many books, about nine of them. But Bye Bye Gaza, it can only be had through lulu.com. My website is the barrychamishwebsite.com, but if you write barrychamish.com, you'll get there. I'm going to give you my cell number. That's for ordering. Well, really, the DVDs are not on Lulu, so you have to contact me. So just dial 904-501-7605, 904-501-7605, only for ordering, please. And if you want to write me, write Chamish, C-H-A-M-I-S-H, at netvision, N-E-T-V-I-S-I-O-N, .net.il, Chamish at netvision.net.il. Now, let's loosen up a little bit, because all of this stuff that we just spoke about is so real. Let's get a little looser. Now, an odd thing happened this week. I only belong to a couple of news groups because they really take up so much computer space, and you're downloading them and you're downloading letters. So I belong to two so I can keep up with Israel and hear a few voices, but not too many. I turned down a lot of invitations to be on people's web pages and faces and whatever they send me, because I just really don't want to be on the computer day and night when it comes to personal correspondence. But on one of these websites, a story came out that China now has got anti-Semitic conspiracy theories blaming the Jews for the state of China's affairs. And I wrote back and I said, finally, the Chinese wake up and they finally see that a Sabbatean named Marx developed a philosophy called communism, which has nothing to do with the Chinese mentality, and that this communism came ultimately from Germany, but it is a Western... it's not just a bureaucratic dictatorship. It's a dictatorship that killed at least 100 million Chinese, about 60 million in the First Cultural Revolution. And I said, finally, the Chinese see that this Mao Zedong and this communism could not have been developed independently in China. It's opposed to the traditional Chinese way of seeing things, and it has nothing to do with Chinese religion, and it's not Confucianism, or it's not Buddhism. It is something imported and brought to the Chinese people by the Sabbateans, by Karl Marx and Engels, through Russia, and with a great deal of American help. The Americans abandoned Chiang Kai-shek, and they secretly supported Mao Zedong. And boy, did I get reaction to this point of view. I was supposed to be shocked that an anti-Semitic theory has now taken hold in China. Now, what I'm shocked at is the Chinese, like so many Americans, like so many people, cannot make that big differentiation between the Sabbateans and the Jews.
Well, Barry, the reason they can't is that most people have never heard the Sabbateans. In fact, I mean, I had to go to the dictionary and look it up. It was the first time I ever heard of the Sabbateans, and found that it certainly was there. A very definite Jewish clique, a very, very small component of the Jewish people, but very, very powerful in modern-day times. It dates back to a man named Sabbati in the 1600s. But the average American has never been allowed to hear about this sect within the Jewish the so-called religion. They're really not Jews at all, but they hide behind the fact that they have Jewish names as they do their evil deeds.
Well, they're not Jewish at all. I mean, we've gone through the fact of John Kerry and Madeleine Albright and the CFR may have had a Jewish background, but they've long past been Jews. They believe in something anti-Jewish. And in fact, without the Sabbateans, there might be as many as 80 million Jews on this planet. Without the Holocaust, without the pogroms, without the assimilation, Jews would not be a disappearing religion. We'd be a vital religion. And now the Chinese have adopted and it's a real problem, by the way, that unless this differentiation can be made, the Jews get blamed for all the world's problems. And by the way, I'm getting phone calls from people saying that the American right-wing radio, unlike this show, by the way, where you give me a chance to explain what, in fact, is the modern history of the Jews. They're blaming the Jews for everything right now.
I know they are. I get so... Fortunately, we used to get a lot of calls that, condemning me because I wouldn't condemn all Jews, and they don't call much anymore. But anyway, go right ahead.
Well, the Chinese now have made the mistake that the American right is making. It's absurd. I got a phone call today condemning the Power Hour and Pastor Butch Pa and that they're all going crazy, and Jack McLam and all these names. I've been in all these shows, by the way, and tried to explain to them that in fact the Israeli people are the greatest victims. What people was wipe off the continent of Europe during the last Holocaust? It's not like anyone else but the Jews are the victims of this. Now, we've got ourselves a real problem in China that the Jews are being blamed, and I keep trying to explain that a Karl Marx in his own time was baptized. Frederick Engels was, if he ever was Jewish, he never, ever admitted it. But nonetheless, it's good that the Chinese recognize, on the one hand, that this awful communism was brought to them by these Sabbateans. It's bad if they mix it up with the Jews. It's a very dangerous thing for the Jewish people that the rest of the world don't understand that we're being attacked by the Sabbateans every bit as much and far more than they're being attacked. There are 1.3 billion Chinese. They may have lost 100 million, but a lot of Chinese survived Mao Zedong. Nonetheless, when I mention this, that it's about time for people's education in China to understand that communism was never supposed to be in China. It's not a Chinese concept. Without a lot of money and a lot of help from the West, there would never have been a communist China. They might have used Russia as a staging point for propaganda and so forth, but ultimately communism comes from Germany and England. That's where communism was developed. And that the Chinese understand this finally, I think is a fine development. I got harangued that everything I do is just like me saying that the protocols of the Elders of Zion was in fact a true statement. And once again, I'm in trouble.
Barry, whenever you stand up, you're going to get into trouble, but you just keep on standing up because you're right on most of these issues, and I certainly support what you're saying.
Well, the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which the people of the world know as a Russian piece of propaganda, put out in 1903 in Moscow, it's wrong. The protocols of the Elders of Zion came out in Paris, France, in 1837, and the Elders of Zion were not even Jews. It was a satire, and probably a real satire, meaning it was probably not a satire. It was probably pure news, but from what I've been reading, it was an expose of the Priory of Zion, or Le Prière de Zion in French. And the Zionists belonged, if you saw the Da Vinci Code, you saw that there was a priory with built by the Templars and protected by the Templars, and apparently had some very serious knowledge to blackmail the Vatican for century upon century, and it in fact ran Europe, built massive cathedrals and castles in medieval time, but the Priory of Zion was the focus of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and it was a French document and not a Russian document. And the real problem with this is that I read history the way it was written, and everyone else thinks it was written in Russia, and that the Jews were Jews and the elders of Zion were Jews, when in fact it was written in France, and the elders of Zion apparently were what became Masons, Freemasons ultimately, but we're talking about the Templars of the Priory of Zion, and that in fact was the protocols of the elders of Zion, for better or worse, and not Jews. And it becomes incredibly frustrating. You start with China and you end up telling the truth, at least giving people the understanding that this document was probably accurate. The only lie was that the elders were Jews.
And I think we're ready, Chris. I've said this a great deal, and I covered it in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and I simply point out that I found a different translation of the protocols in Colonel House's papers. Colonel House was the man who controlled both Woodrow Wilson and FDR, his papers back at the Sterling Library at Yale University. And, of course, Colonel House was deeply involved with the occult. And I believe this document was really written by the occultist. In fact, there's a Jewish scholar named Professor Cohn, Norman Cohn, I think it is, who wrote a book, and the name escapes me right now, but anyway, of course, he attributed it to exactly these same occult people, these same occult forces, who I believe, of course, has always wanted to pull attention away from themselves and then focus the attention on the Jews, because if you get into the occult movement, they are violently anti-Semitic. They already have been, whether it be Madame Blavatsky or Alice Bailey or any of the other people there. And I believe they wrote this, smuggled it into Russia. And, of course, this is what Warrant for Genocide, I think, was Norman Cohn's book, as I remember.
Well, I'm not sure how it became a Russian tool, but I am sure that it was first seen in Paris in 1837, and I'm not sure when it was written it was an occult book. I think it was actually, well, occult tract. I think it was an accurate expose of the Priory of Zion. What it became was something else, but neither here nor there. I don't think it was a lie when it came out. It was an accurate expose of the finaglings of Catholic Europe through the Priory of Zion. That's what the elders of Zion were, members of this priory. But neither here nor there, you can't even say that. The world has taken a history of its own, and no one seems to want to look at an alternative history, that maybe this thing was not a hoax. Maybe when it came out as a legitimate expose of something. But you note the word Jew is nowhere in the protocols, and this is not brought up by anyone, that the actual protocols was a French product, not a Russian product, and it's older than what people think by a good 70 years. Nonetheless, we entered that domain where everything I write has got to be wrong, because the use of the protocols was an anti-Semitic use. It floats all across the Arab world. The Arabs read it. They think it's about Israel, and that's just the way things are, that it doesn't matter truth or not, that no Arab even cares when it was written. As far as they were concerned, there are 300 Jews plotting the disruption of the world societies so they can control them, and that's not the way the protocols of the elders of Zion was written, and it was not written about Jews. So we stray from the normal course to clean up history a little bit, but now we can go back to the normal course. Number one, there was a meeting in Rome this week with, well, Edgar Bronfman of the Council on Foreign Relations and Ronald Lauder of the Council on Foreign Relations, so-called Jewish leaders of America, were meeting Pope Benedict this week in the Vatican. Now, who wants to invite these two, and why does the Pope Benedict the 16th thinks that these two deserve a meeting with him. Nevertheless, that meeting took place, and we'll have to live with it one way or another, that the American leaders of American Jewry met with Pope Benedict the 16th in Rome this week, and God knows what they really discussed.
Well, let's hope that they don't really represent American Jewry, because I think that they have their own agenda. I think a couple of Soti Brafman is one of the most evil people around. He's the fellow who stole the $6 billion that was given to him to give to the Holocaust survivors, and he just never could figure out who they were, so he kept the money. That's the most incredible story.
Indeed it is.
We'll be back in just a moment with our good friend Barry Shamish as we explore really what's happening in Israel and how it's going to impact on us right here in America. Well, Barry, you go ahead and wrap up the program here. You got 3 minutes.
Oh, boy. Well, it went quickly as usual, and tomorrow at 10 we're back together. Sandy Berger is going to be, when the Hillary Clinton wins the election, it looks like he's going to be the Secretary of State. Sandy Berger, the one who stole secret documents from, I believe it was the Navy Library. Nonetheless, he's a thief. Well, Hillary is getting advice from the man who in 1982, along with Shimon Peres and Yossi Sarid, plotted the end of Menachem Begin and sabotaged his winning war against the PLO in Lebanon. That was the president of Peace Now America, Sandy Berger, who is a caught thief and who is a snake, he's the one advising, apparently not just as a friend, but from a very high level. He is Hillary Clinton's advisor. She will not use the word chief advisor, but this crook who has done his level best to destroy Israel, who has stolen from your own Washington hyper-secret library, sticking documents down his pants, is, in fact, Hillary Clinton's partner in winning the next election, and he is on the short list to become your Secretary of State. And I don't know what it means, but this man hates Israel. He is, as I said, the former president of Peace Now, which is busy at work destroying Israel. In case anyone, I don't believe anyone in this audience is going to vote Hillary Clinton necessarily, but keep that in mind.
Well, I certainly think it's going to be a very interesting time this coming year as we've determined, of course, who the next president is going to be, but I suspect that it's not going to be somebody who believes in America or believes in Israel. I fear that we will get one of those Republicans, Me Too Republicans, and what a horrible thought to have a choice between that and Hillary Clinton is like a choice between being shot or being hung. I really don't like either alternative.
Well, you don't vote. I mean, really, there's no reason to vote anymore. You just don't vote.
Well, I will vote, but I probably will not vote for a mainline party ticket. In fact, we'll just wait and see. I still have fools rush in when angels fear the tread. Who knows? We might have a real American candidate. We'll wait and see. Anyway, God bless you, Barry. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You got it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoy our conversations with Barry Shamish. Of course, if you'd like to get the entire tape, or we do talk through the breaks, why, they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to understand the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which is one of the most important documents ever written, it was circulated in Russia in the early 1900s and then became the basis of the pogroms and the anti-Semitism, which was in Russia that preceded the Russian Revolution, that of course was taken to Germany and was used, of course, to foment the Nazi Party, the Nazi movement built upon anti-Semitism. Today it's circulating widely in both the Arab world and in the Chinese world. What is the background of this? Who really wrote the protocols? Well, you'd certainly want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, because we give you an excellent overview and where you can actually get the information written by people who've studied this for years. There's a number of books written by James Webb. He wrote three of them on the occult hierarchy, the occult underground, and I forgot the name of the third one. But, of course, going into the background of how the protocols were written by the occultists, these people who were Luciferians, who really, of course, wanted to throw attention on the Jews for what was going on, rather than have the people understand that it was they, these members of these occult organizations, specifically the Theosophists, who were really behind what was going on in the world. My book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will give you the documentation. We do actually have the full text of the copies of the protocols that I found in Colonel House's papers at Yale University. Why is that significant? Well, first of all, why did Colonel House leave them there, knowing they would be found by some researcher in the future? But why are they a different translation than any you will find any other place? My conjecture, and that is, it's only conjecture, but they came from the original translation, not the one that, of course, was sent to Russia, translated into Russian, then, of course, taken to England, where it was translated into English by a fellow named Victor Marsden, and then circulated here in America by Henry Ford, who was deeply involved in the occult. Henry Ford, of the Ford Motor Company, was involved with the occult. He backed both the Nazi movement and the communist movement. And of course, you can only understand why the Ford Foundation has financed subversive organizations since its inception in the early part of the last century by understanding that the man who created the Ford Foundation, Henry Ford, was certainly deeply involved in this world Luciferian movement. When you understand that, you understand that J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, the Rockefeller family, they've all been involved in this. At that point, things began to make sense. Read the Earth Charter, which, of course, is written by Nelson Rockefeller's son, Professor Stephen Rockefeller. It is the Mein Kampf for everything going on today. And it speaks of a new spirituality. But, of course, what they're really talking about is doing away with the old spirituality, the belief in the God of the Bible and Christianity. Well, please don't forget, of course, about our all-day conference on the 28th of October. That's the 28th of October, and I hope many of you can come. We're bringing in speakers from across the country, and there'll be people here from across the country as well. Looks like we're going to get a good turnout. Hope you can make it. That's the 28th of October. You'll need to have a reservation, so our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to come. That's 1-800-544-8927. Lunch is going to be served. Doors will open at 7:30. Program will start at 8:30 and run until 5:30. It'll be a fascinating time. Again, if you'd like to understand the protocols, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will give you a good background and give you the references to Professor Norman Cohn's book, A Warrant for Genocide, James Webb's books. The value of Brotherhood of Darkness is the other books that you can begin to read to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged. You want to get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. The occult hierarchy, there are three of them, they come together. There really are forces out there that most people have no idea about. We'll be back in just, tomorrow at the same time. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty.